the Left Forum, and also to the panel hosted by the Platypus Affiliated Society, Beyond Sect or Movement, What is a Political Center? And the goal of this panel is to take up the recent popularity and interest in Hal Draper's 1973 essay, The Anatomy of the Microsect. And with us today, we have three panelists to discuss this question. And I will introduce them in a moment. And let me read first the description of the panel, and then I'll introduce the panelists, and we can get going. So one moment as I pull up this description. Beyond Sector Movement, What is a Political Center? In his 1973 essay, Anatomy of the Microsect, Hal Draper gives a definition of a party as opposed to a movement or the sects that seem to dominate the left of his time. Quote, a sect presents itself as the embodiment, Richard is calling me, Jesus, of the socialist movement, though it is a membership organization whose boundary is set more or less rigidly by the points in its political program rather than by its relation to the social struggle. In contrast, a working class party is not simply an electoral organization, but rather, whether electorally engaged or not, an organization which really is the political arm of decisive sectors of the working class, which politically reflects or refracts the working class in motion as it is. A so-called socialist movement sums up the mass manifestations of a socialist working class in various fields, not only the political, usually around a mass socialist party, end quote. Against both the sect and merely building a movement, Draper argues for the formation of a political center, which would be different from a unification of sects as a first step towards the goal of building a socialist party. How is our present moment similar to or different from that of Draper? What is a socialist party, and what are the greatest obstacles today to its realization, and how can those obstacles be met? Hal Draper was deeply influenced by his study of Marx and Marxism when he wrote this essay. What can we learn from Hal Draper's Marxism today? And so we asked the panelists to consider the questions and the description, but of course, they're free to speak on the topic as they please. And so we will speak in seated order from audience viewpoint left to right, and I will introduce our panelists in that order. So first, on my left, the first speaker, Michael Hirsch, is a New York-based labor and politics writer, a longtime editor with New Politics magazine, and a moderator for the Portside News Service. A recently enlisted sympathizing member of Solidarity and a founding member of DSA's labor and lower Manhattan branches. Michael is an erstwhile sociologist with advanced degrees in sociology and journalism. He was a militant with the International Socialists from 1972 until 1986, and organizer of its Boston branch before industrializing as a steel worker in Gary, Indiana, for 5 years until the mass layoffs in 1982. Coming to New York in 1986, he worked as a labor editor and writer for an AFSCME council, for a local SEIU, and for 13 years before retiring in 2013 for the United Federation of Teachers. A member of DSA since 2003, he was a member of its National Political Committee and Steering Committee for 3 terms and an editor of its quarterly journal, Democratic Left. His writing has appeared in Jacobin, The New Statesman, Village Voice, The NY Observer, City Limits, Crane's NY Business, New Labor Forum, The Independent, and other venues. He considers himself a revolutionary democratic socialist and aspires to act like one. Next, in the middle, is Jim Cregan. Jim Cregan was chairman of the Penn State chapter of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, in the 1960s, lectured in philosophy in the 70s, belonged to the Spartacist League in the 80s, was a leading member of the International Bolshevik Tendency and a union shop steward during the late 80s and 90s. His writing from recent years may be found in the Weekly Worker. He lives in New York City, now unaffiliated but unresigned. And finally, we have Spencer Leonard. He is a founding member of the Platypus Affiliated Society, and he's a professor. Spencer, where are you teaching now?
University of Virginia.
He's a professor at the University of Virginia. We were going to be joined by Grant Gallagher, who unfortunately cannot make it. So best wishes to him this weekend, and we will miss him. So for the panel format, each speaker will have up to 15 minutes to speak. I'll give a signal when there's 5 minutes left, and then 2 and 1 minute. After that, each panelist will be invited to respond to one another for 3 to 4 minutes. Then we'll open it up to audience Q&A. Okay, thanks. Take it away, Mike.
Before I start, I want to make it clear that I have a lot of respect for Hal Graber. So this sounds caustic, take that in context. I learned a lot from Hal. Saying that, to my mind, Hal Graber's anatomy of the microset would better be called remarks on sectarianism from a recovering sect addict. Graber was the veteran of innumerable tendency wars. Not only were his principles carved in stone, he used them as rhetorical cudgels as well. Still, remarks today are not meant to challenge those principles, foundational and resolute as they may be, only to question their application in the essay under discussion. Draper's well-articulated principles of socialism from below, the self-emancipation of the working class, accept no substitutes, and the need for an activist, authentically mass-based political party, independent of and in contention with bourgeois parties, are my political guideposts as well. It's the implementation of the three that is the historical sticking point. Then, too, given how right Draper has been about so many things, not least of which is documenting the self-activity of working people worldwide, it may sound churlish to criticize him, but as Marx wrote, quote, "The task confronting us at present is the ruthless criticism of the existing order, ruthless in that it will shrink neither from its own discoveries nor from conflict with the powers that be." So even as good a seer as Ms. Draper, he can be fairly criticized too. Take, for example, his defenses of Lenin and the mass character of the first and second Russian revolutions. They were fine as far as they go, but much of this success was sui generis, that is, it was singular. A collapsing Russian empire brought down in large measure by defeat in a punishing world war, occurring in a largely agrarian country and whose inheritors were faced with creating an egalitarian society amid the wreckage or die trying was an impossible task. Impossible especially when no help came from what was hoped would be workers' revolutions in a highly industrialized West. Help that could move the British and US incursions into the Civil War and gin up the ravaged Russian domestic economy. That grim reality was no model for emulation, if for no other reason than the external and internal conditions that brought down the old order were a perfect storm, but no basis for moving forward. Lenin built a democratic mass party that could read the tenor of the times, weigh the contention of class forces, and intervene masterfully. But it took nearly 20 years to build that party, and in particular conditions not repeated elsewhere. Nothing of the sort obtained in the West, whether in post-war Italy, where worker upsurges were isolated to the north, or in Germany, whose Social Democratic Party aligned with the bourgeoisie and elements of the working class to destroy every spark of working class upsurge, or in Britain and France, where the old order remained unchallenged and unchanged. Least of all the United States, where war fever meant the extermination of cadres of the industrial workers of the world, the demise of the Socialist Party, and the rise of not one, but two tenuous communist parties. Draper elsewhere could examine minutely why working class leaderships in World War I could traitorously support their own imperial ruling classes in war, largely on the basis that trade union leaders and party officials had more to lose from opposing war than from heralding it. The union tops and the party apparatchiks who backed their own government's war efforts were not simply some of us are not like taking up the handle of a machine like this. Draper never had the handle of a machine like this. Nothing of the sort of contained in the West, whether in post-war Italy, whose worker upsurges were isolated to the North, or in Germany, whose social democratic party allied with the bourgeoisie and elements of the upper class to destroy every spark of working class upsurge, or in Britain and France, where the old order remained unchallenged and unchanged, least of all in the United States. All right, Draper elsewhere could examine minutely why working class leaderships in World War I could traitorously support their own imperial powers. This is not working.
Okay.
I mean, this is not working.
All right, well, then just keep going.
I'm talking about the class in the West, by trade union leaders, in supporting their own nations, and had to do less with their agreement on the need for imperialism, and more to do with the fact that they had positions that could be sacrificed had they opposed their own war. The same was true of the trade union leaders in Britain, who called off the general strike in 1926 and sold out the striking miners. When confronted with a revolutionary situation, they didn't so much choke as follow their short-term vested interest in caving to their Tory masters. Draper would agree to this analysis. In fact, I accreted much of it from him and his circle. But he is silent in the essay on the review on what sort of movement could challenge and reverse the self-interested bureaucratic radicacy. Not a Leninist party, he asserts, certainly not a micro sect pretending to be a small mass party, and he'd be right. But if not that, if not a centralized party, then what? Certainly not Keynesian-style reforms, best exemplified by the counter-cyclical planning of the French Popular Front, and its efforts to increase wages, shorten the work week, create public works to cut unemployment, and increase consumer demand. These good efforts were far more extensive even than FDR's New Deal, but were soon undone by French bourgeois opposition and replaced by a center-right government imposing harsh, prudent, quote-unquote, prudent finance policies of cover for austerity and ruling class theft. So much for Leon Blum's off-quoted as true of the conquest of power in preference to the exercise of power. The Popular Front leader in briefly French head of state, in effect, got neither. That is, he didn't get to reign very long, didn't get to exercise power very long, and certainly didn't get to reign. Yet with Draper's no sectarians deal by credo, would he, if still among us, bend the stick just a bit to acknowledge that support for Bernie Sanders in the 8-month run-up to Super Tuesday isn't a fatal flaw. In truth, while I wear a Labor for Bernie button and talk him up, I'm hardly sold on the Bernie venture, but I won't condemn it. It's a tactical shift that he's exploring, at least. But my larger point is this: whatever is wrong with what passes on the American left for a Leninist party, those various groups are right to recognize that the victories of fascism in Spain in 1938 and Chile in the 1970s were the outcomes of challenging capital on one hand, but still fatally flawed by not nurturing a political party in command aimed not just at governing, but at reigning. That is, in exercising power. That was clearly not the Spanish Communist goal under the Popular Front. The PUM was too small and too underfunded to offer much resistance in Spain at that time, as George Orwell, for one, testifies, and the anarchists in Catalonia were isolated and outgunned. Nor was Allende's Socialist Party in Chile aimed at a social revolution either, let alone an insurrection, though it clearly threatened U.S. investments, which were dangerous enough for Henry Kissinger and the CIA. Allende, like generations of European reformist socialists, thought he could beat the governing classes at their own game. He paid with his life, as did thousands of others. Draper is, of course, right that a revolutionary party can't be hothouse. It can't be simply invoked. It must be based on facts on the ground, of course, but it can't be whisked away either, or treated like a contagion, or simply denigrated as does here. Leninists are comrades too. A little biography here. I was never a member of the recently suicided International Socialist Organization, nor was I ever interested in joining them. Too many subterranean intrigues.
Time.
absolutely worthless. I'm sorry, I apologize for this. I apologize for my incompetence.
No, we never should have left the printed page.
All right. I'm saying that the identity of the ISO because there are too many subterranean intrigues, too many foundational principles that serve more as prayer wheels than as guides to legitimate action. Too many excuses for electoral abstentions, even the few that had merit, especially when taken under the label of the Democratic Party. I joined the DSA 60 years ago, knowing all its faults, its one-dimensional electoral enchantments, its careerist fascinations, its long-time avoidance of trade union struggles, except when aligned with a few labor tops as footstools. All these were at best a default position. Draper left the International Socialists in 1972 over an issue that at the time, to me, I was brand new to the organization, an issue at the time seemed picayune. He thought we were ultra-left on the trade union question. And we may have been ultra-left on the trade union question for maybe 6 months. We were one of the first groups to talk about a deep dive into industrial work. We believed, as he did, and learned from him, that a rank-and-file strategy, building militancy on the shop floor, was the basis for building socialism in America. Not to run candidates for office, but to have a deep and abiding influence among the rank-and-file, which we felt was being ill-used by bureaucratic trade union leadership. At the time, we took a line that said, many of the unions are useless and we organize struggle groups against the unions. That point of view lasted perhaps 6 months. That was heresy to Draper and he left. The criticism I had of Draper at the time, and I would still have, is that he may have left a sect, but then he became a sect of one person. One of the jokes we used to have was, did you hear what happened? Hal split from Draper. One of the things I've learned is that if you think sectarianism is a danger, the problem is that the people who leave the sects stay sectarian. It's just that their principles become principles that they use not as a way of encouraging others to work better, but as a way of differentiating themselves from others. If you come in today, you'll see people from different Trotsky sects preaching not just a better way for us to work together, but their way. As though truth resides in the particular formulation that they have developed about key things. The old debates we used to have in the left were about two things. One was the class nature of the Democratic Party, and secondly, the class nature of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union did the American left a great service by collapsing. And when it collapsed, we didn't have that problem anymore, trying to define the class nature of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, we just had to define the class nature of our own fights. I think in many ways, Draper did two things once he left the sect that he so precipitously avoided. One was to become a first-rate Marxist intellectual, writing for a magazine that he would, writing for a publishing house, his magazine would never print it, a monthly review, and then to write a five-volume study of Marx, which is among the best ever written in any language. And if you haven't read Draper and Marx, you are missing something serious. But the politics of the document that we're reading today is so diffuse that it begs the question, what the hell would people be able to do? Where is the direction? I would reject the idea that a party like, and I don't mean to insult anybody, they have to be members of the Spartacist League, but the problem with the Spartacist League has always been their political line was seen as refreshing and revolutionary in a way that had no bearing on their ability to intervene anywhere. I once read a major essay by them, an entire issue of their magazine, taken up with an attack on Ernest Mandel for opportunism here, 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 and here. You finish the article and you say, you know, Ernest took a lot of shortcuts, and perhaps he shouldn't have. But the bottom line is, he built something that intervenes in the class. You guys haven't built something that intervenes in the class. If you can't build a movement, shut the fuck up. And that's what I said in 15 pages. So I'm sorry, I can't read it. I apologize, and perhaps it will come back in discussion. Just to say this, I joined DSA in large measure because there's nothing else to join. It's really a very diffuse organization, very frustrating. It is also largely a youth organization now, and I feel I'm with my grandchildren and not my children anymore. I just hit 74 the other day. I'm far and away the oldest person in my branch. I've had a lot of experiences that these young folks never had. One of the things that they prize and that I prize is I was a steel worker for 5 years. I probably would have made a career out of that. Had the mills all shut down, they didn't all shut down, they largely shut down in 1982. I had no choice but to become a labor bureaucrat after that. What can you do after putting out a ragged farm newspaper? Become a labor journalist and get hired by a union in New York City, which is far enough away from Gary. So that's largely my history. I leave it to you. I apologize for not being able to finish this. I probably left things out, but let's leave it at that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just like to second the previous speaker that in saying that after he quit politics in 1970 and took the scholarship, produced some very excellent results, and this is the five volume Marxist theory of revolution that has been referred to, and we're doing a study in the Marxist educational project, which I belong to, which meets at the Commons and the People's Forum in the fall. We hope to get through all of those five volumes, supplemented by the political writings of Marx and Engels. So I invite any interested person to check this out. Now, I have been asked to speak here on a subject in which I have no particular expertise, organizational forms of the revolutionary left. What I can speak to is my own experience of 15 years in groups that I think can be very accurately described as sects. I belonged to the Spartacist League for 5 years. And during that time, it was from about 1981 to 1986, but despite the heavily political presence of the sectarian presence, but the heavily political presence of the Spartacist League at public events, it was, I soon found out, a personality cult around its founder leader, James Robertson, who died at the beginning of April. So I don't know what the Spartacist League is today, or how long it will last, but Bogart was definitely a personality cult when I belonged to it. And then I spent the next 10 years in one of the derivative products of these pharmacist league, called the International Bolshevik Tendency, which was not a cult, but it was a sect. It was almost a Simon Pure example of a sect. And what do I mean by that? I mean that it was dedicated to carrying out something that it considered as the internally valid Trotskyist program dating from the revolution and more recently from the transitional program of 1938. It thought that that program remained valid regardless of what happened in the world, and had no clue in terms of analyzing newer developments in the class struggle and in politics. And that group, with its fewer than 20 members, has now a rare distinction, perhaps, among Trotskyist movements. They have recently had a split over the Russian question, 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that says it all. But after I left this group 20 years ago, one of the things that I pondered was what led to the sectarian group pathologies. And I noticed these things, that this fate befell not only the Spartacist League, not only the Helianic Workers League, and not only the Workers' World Party, and so many other, and more recently the ISL, that is, they degenerated and failed, ultimately. So it happened not to my group, but to a number of leftist groups, most of the small revolutionary groups, in fact. So then I had a blinding flash of insight, which I don't think has occurred to any of the members of these groups, that it may not be something in their theory and practice that is wrong, and it accounts for their failure. But rather something in the objective situation that they all faced. And that is, I think, first of all, post-war capitalism, which they did not realize, was different in fundamental ways from the capitalism of the crisis-prone capitalism of the interwar years. There was a boom, what the French called the Trente Guerre, that is the 30 years following World War II, in which workers standards of living of many key sections of the working class, certainly not all, were improving steadily, and the organizations that tried to carry out a revolutionary program could not find a mass base in the working class, which in the Trotskyist tradition that I belong to is the criterion of failure or success, simply because of the relatively prosperous conditions that most workers, and especially a lot of unionized workers, were not interested in revolutionary ideas. And that, post-war prosperity began coming to an end in the 1970s. That was followed by a vicious capitalist attack on all fronts, for which the workers' movement and the socialist movement was completely unprepared. It involved attacks on unions, on wages, and internationally culminated in the downfall of the Soviet Union. I may disagree with you on this. I don't think that was a positive development. I think it set the workers and socialist movement backwards 2 decades. In this situation, there was with socialism discredited, with those elements of the working class that believed in it ceasing to believe in it, with them leftists moving consistently to the right, there was very little chance of a working class revival and a socialist revival. And I think that Draper's insight about political censure has a lot of validity to it. But unfortunately, that the article that we're considering here today was written at precisely the time when this neoliberal offensive was beginning, so that the strategy he advocates of trying to find the movement where in the organizations you are, where you work, etc., and then kind of cohering into a political center, that was foredoomed in 1974 when he wrote the article. But I think if you look at the history of the movement, of the workers' movement, you can find a strong validation of the point that he makes, because the main counterexample has always been considered the Leninist Party and the party that Lenin founded, which was supposedly strongly programmatically based. But if you study the actual history of Russian social democracy, you will find that in the antecedents at least, the Bolsheviks did not arise by Lenin and his collaborators saying, "We've drawn up a program, go down on your knees before it." What happened was somewhat different. Lenin came out of Siberian exile shortly before 1900, and went into exile in Western Europe in various cities, and he put into practice a scheme that had gestated in his mind during his exile year, and that was to found a newspaper, Iskra, it was called. And now the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party did have a congress, I believe, in 1899 in Minsk, there were nine people in attendance, and seven of them were arrested immediately after the congress, so this kind of a non-event. But what Lenin did was establish his newspaper, which was smuggled 5 minutes in and out of Russia. The editorial board added articles in its own, and then smuggled it back in. And it was around Iskra that you developed this whole network of correspondents and smugglers and people who had skills like coding invisible ink, and the Russian socialist movement was completely illegal. And it did two things. It was based on study circles and the rising workers' movement that already existed. Lenin did not create those things. But it gave to them, because of Tsarist repression, these movements were highly local, and it was very difficult for them to gain any sense of themselves as a national movement or party. When Iskra came, you could report on events all over Russia and give this movement for the first time a sense of national coherence, and that is what Lenin did. But also, the organization that developed around the newspaper gave Lenin the foundation of a real political party, which announced its triumph at the Second Congress, which was really the founding Congress in 1903, and then split into Bolshevik and Menshevik factions. Now, I went on this longer than I had intended, but I suppose I just want to say, do I have a minute?
Yes, you have time.
What?
You have 4 minutes.
Oh, I have 4 minutes? Nice. Okay. Because this wasn't intended simply as a historical lecture. It was I intended to say a few words about what we have today. Because I think the neoliberal is pretty clear, the capitalist neoliberal fix is coming to an end, and that we have today something that can be called a movement, which came into being. It had certain precursors in Occupy, in the Union Rebellion in Wisconsin, and in the teacher strikes that have taken place around the country, but its main demiurge at this point has been the Sanders campaign. And that has activated a lot of people. The political center of that movement, I think we have something that can be described as that as a political center as well, and that is DSA, and the publication closely associated with it, Jacobin. We have to, this is a positive development. We've wandered for a long time in the desert, but we also have to interrogate the politics of this new movement and this new political center. And I think it's pretty clear that despite a lot of revolutionary phraseology and talk about a clean or dirty race with the Democratic Party, class struggle, social democracy, so forth and so on, this political center is decidedly reformist in its politics. And despite all its talk about political strategies, the main thing that DSA does right now on the ground is to go and to canvas for the various left-wing political left Democrats, whose program is pretty clearly first of all, almost exclusively electoral, and secondly, they want to reconstitute the New Deal. We can talk about this more in discussion. I, for one, don't happen to think that it is possible. It is possible at this point to reconstitute the New Deal, or to proceed to remake the country through a set of gradual reforms. I don't have time to talk about why. I think the question that we face is we can't ignore this movement, nor can we ignore the very real changes that are taking place in the Democratic Party, the conflicts. Read today's New York Times if you have any doubts. There's a headline about how alarmed the centrists in the Democratic Party have become by the recent debate. But the question that revolutionary Marxists like myself face is how to intersect this movement, because it should not be ignored. Thousands and thousands of people are pouring into it in all parts of the country. But how to intersect it, move it in a left-wing direction without fostering the reformist illusions that most people who adhere to it definitely possess at this point. And I won't try to answer that now. I leave my presentation at that question.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to thank Aaron and also want to thank Michael and Jim. It's an honor to share the panel with them. Some of this I probably just could have asked them, but instead I went to California to look through Hal Draper's archives, which are massive, just beginning to work through.
Speak up.
I was saying I probably could have just asked you, but instead I went to California and read through Hal Draper's archives. But I want to focus on, in a sense, occasions digressions seemingly into the history of the Bolshevik Party, into the practice of Marx and Engels politically. What is the connection between, in a sense, the political history of this moment in of the transition of the New Left from the time of the 60s and the student movements, the broader social movements, and in the industrialization of a generation of convert, of New Left convert, whether by Trotskyist groups like the IS or the Maoist groups. In his recently published Socialist Manifesto, Jacobin editor Bhaskar Sankara defends extending the gains of reforms achieved in the 20th century. But the 20th century, when those supposed gains were won, was a period of counter-revolution, one in which the prospect of the achievement of socialism, socialism instead of capitalism, but also socialism beyond capitalism, achieved on the basis of capitalism, has receded beyond view. By the notion of the gains of reform, Sankara can only mean the policies of the capitalist state, as the labor movement has only grown disorganized and socialism as an independent politics has collapsed. Certainly, none can claim today what was widely acknowledged by friend and foe alike a century ago, that the future belongs to socialism. We may argue that socialism is necessary, even possible, but not likely in the sense that this was felt, even assumed, even in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Hal Draper was young enough to feel the failure of socialism, the failure of Marxism, better the interminable crisis unto death of Marxism. But he was too old to take it for granted, to need to forcibly suppress the recognition, as did arguably the generation that came after. Giving his life and intellect over to the practical struggle for socialism in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, Draper eventually dropped out of organized leftist politics to devote the final two decades of his life to answering the questions, who was Marx, and what was Marxism? Could the historical experience stretching from the French Revolution to the Russian Revolution, at the center of which stood Marx in 1848, could that history, in some sense, be repeated, only this time with greater historical consciousness, and thus brought to resolution? Could the world's historic struggle for socialism be brought to bear upon the present? Could the task that humanity set itself in the 19th century be completed? Or was the 20th century process of historical regression and social disintegration inexorable? In short, Draper raises the question that Sankara seeks to displace: the reality in and through material gains of interminable defeat and counter-revolution. Draper thus negatively raises the possibility by raising the question of the history of Marxism, of capitalism's destruction and realization through the mastery of its negative historical dialectic in the 20th century. Throughout the history of Marxism, even before its death agony, the return to Marx has been central to the struggle to achieve the overcoming of its own crises. The history of Marxism itself, both intellectually and historically, is an ongoing attempt to recover and reassert Marxist Marxism in the face of Marxism's crisis, in the face of revisionism, etc., the liquidation of Marxism and the conversion of socialism into just another Bonapartist project. The answer to the failure of Marxism has always met with the reassertion of revolutionary Marxism, whether against Bernstein and the revisionism of the SPD, against Kautsky's renegacy, against the Mensheviks and the waverers amongst the Bolsheviks themselves, or against Stalinism and the transformation of the legacy of Marxism into a great organizer of defeat. In the period that we left, there was an attempt, the last significant attempt, to recover Marx and Marxism. Hal Draper, arguably the greatest intellectual dedicated to recovering Marx's own political thought in the second half of the 20th century, was central to that attempted recovery. Crucially, Draper privileged the working through and re-achievement of historical consciousness, if only intellectually, to that of joining the late New Left, many of whom he trained in plunging into the industrialization of the 1970s and 80s, the birth of the modern sectarian landscape. Today, the endless spate of historical materialism, verso, and academic press publications on Marx's so-called social theory typically do not so much as touch upon the core question of Marx's project of politically mastering democracy to achieve proletarian socialism, for which the student today is still well advised to digest Marx Draper's 5 volumes on the subject. If only as one of the last and necessarily distorted attempts at returning to Marx. While I can't go into this here, in the Q&A we can perhaps discuss the way in which Draper's work circles around the question of democracy as a kind of psychic wound, and this is coming out of his experience in the Chapmanov tradition, I believe. At all events, Draper deliberately attempts to clear Marx's Marxism from the distortions imposed by the 20th century experience of counter-revolution, by social democracy, by communism, and ultimately by the New Left's failure to overcome the mid-century crisis of both. In short, if there still be a young person capable of mistrusting the affirmative history on offer from Jacobin's from the Socialist Manifesto by Jack Bennett, Draper can help them to read the history of the left against the grain. He cannot, however, help much in the way millennials are trying to use him, which is as a guide or a map to the present. In 1970, and this is something that Michael already talked about, in 1970, more or less immediately following the establishment of the IS, Hal Draper and others launched an attempt to steer the fledgling organization towards a long-term strategy for achieving socialism in the United States. This meant for Draper strangling the organization in its cradle, calling themselves the Reorient Tendency. Draper and others embarked on a struggle within the IS to abandon the path of what he termed the sect, arguing that the sect form of American socialist groupment today is a roadblock. Because in the end, Draper and his circle simply resigned from the IS with the least possible fuss. This is the way he puts it in his open letter when he resigns. None of these documents were published at the time. None of the internal documents of the IS. In recent years, too, toward the beginning of another row, The Alternative to the Microsect from 1971, The Anatomy of the Microsect from 1970. Have appeared on Marxist.org, where they have met with an unlikely fascination from young people. Most important among the Reorient papers yet to appear are Draper's Turning Point, The Nature of the Crisis in the IS, and Ernie Haberkern's Sectarianism or Marxism, A Review of the Issues in Dispute, both from 1970. Even as these documents circulated within the IS, Draper was prosecuting his arguments in another mode, as an argument about history. Bound together with every copy of the Reorient papers in the Hal Draper archives are announcements for lecture series delivered by himself and his wife Anne in the autumn of 1870 on the subject of socialism and the labor movement. The final sheet in the collection is an announcement for another lecture series, this one on revolution and revolutionary organization, 1789, 1848, 1871, and 1905, of which, to my knowledge, no published version exists. In addition to lecturing, Draper in these years intensified his writings on Marxism. publishing Marx and Engels on Women's Liberation, The Death of the State in Marx and Engels, and the write-up of the lecture series mentioned above, Marxism and the Trade Unions, all in 1970, the principle of self-emancipation in Marx and Engels in 1971, the concept of the local proletariat in Marx and Engels in 1972, and Marx on democratic forms of government in 1974. Clearly, all the thinking that went into Draper's five volumes, the first volume of which appears in 77, had already begun before Draper's departure from the IRS. With the partial exception of Microsect, all of the Reorient Tendency documents argue for the industrialization of cadre and for a rank-and-file long-term strategy for building socialism in a non-pre-revolutionary period, as he puts it. Draper took it to be a non-pre-revolutionary period despite the experience of the 60s and despite the growing labor militancy associated with the new unionism of the early 1970s in which he was writing. In the short run, at least, cadre were to take union jobs and to help lead the worker struggles within those unions, while others were to form a Marxist center, i.e. to undertake a publishing program that was to begin with the publishing of books and pamphlets. While it is unclear from the available party internal documents, by the time that Draper comes to write Microsect, at least, it is clear that he considered cadre formation within the labor movement really as a task to be undertaken by individuals, while a small clutch of intellectuals, self-selected on the basis of mutual affinity, not election by any membership organization, were to form a Marxist center. It is unclear to this author, at least, whether this is continuous with his perspective going back into 1968-69. At that time, in any event, he noted that when new opportunities unfolded, a good part, here he's talking about the experience of 1968, a good part of what considers itself the new left was either co-opted or else coughed out, whether by turning to the Democrats or, quote, blustering about destroying America, urban guerrillaism, and other manifestations of the politics of impotence, unquote. At that point, at least, Draper seemed to be arguing for the building of a sect, or put more neutrally, a membership organization. What we need to transform America in the long run are serious revolutionists, I'm quoting again, with a long-term commitment and perspective. That excludes the court jesters. It also excludes the types who are all ready to cop out as soon as they turn 30, after which they will be able to explain indulgently to their sons, who will show their rebellion by being clean-shaven, that they too were radicals when they were young and irresponsible. Being a serious revolutionist means, to begin with, training yourself in a Marxist understanding of society, and as a militant in the mass struggles in our day. The more serious revolutionists we can produce, the easier it will be also to build a broad, independent, radical movement and party, for you cannot do this without a vanguard. That's written in the fall of 1968. By the 1970s, Draper instead seems to be arguing that the only connection between socialists in the labor movement those of the Marxist center or centers would be that the former would look to the latter for ideological sustenance by purchasing and or subscribing to their publications, which for its part were to help generalize their experience beyond their particular circumstances. And here the historical analogy is this drop. At most in time, Draper suggests the Marxist center would evolve alongside the growing mobilization of labor, this to the point that socialists within the labor movement would report in and to a center publication on developments within their union and industries, as well as upon wider democratic struggles. The intermediate goal was the creation on the basis of a mobilized labor movement of a workers' politics, a presumably multi-tendency, i.e. multi-centered socialist political party on the analogy of the RSDLP of the 1890s and 1900s. In this sense, Draper envisioned a replay, not 20th century struggle for socialism, but of the history of Marx and Marxism from 1848 to 1917. The lesson of the 20th century in this sense was that there was no lesson to be drawn from it, except the wrong ones, roadblocks.
What was the very last thing you said? I couldn't hear.
The lesson of the 20th century was that there was no lesson to be drawn except the wrong ones. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Spencer. Thank you, all the panelists. Now I'd like to invite the panelists for a brief, you know, about 3 to 4 minute, if you'd like, or less if you want, responses to one another, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. So Michael could go first.
Well, again, I will apologize for the kerfuffle. There's a lot of material here. I can't even remember half of what I wrote. Otherwise, I would really commiserate it for you. It's very tough to criticize Draper. First of all, he's not alive anymore. Secondly, so much of his work is so worthwhile, so smart, that I feel like an ungrateful child for taking him on. I was 26 when I met him. I do believe that when you leave a sect, you don't necessarily stop being a sectarian, you just become a sectarian of one. And in many ways, when Draper left the IS, he didn't do what he said he wanted to do. That movement that he developed, those centers, never cohered. The publishing house that he and Ernie Havergarten put together was largely reprints from older tracts. In terms of a strategy, he didn't really have one. Now saying that, I also want to point out to other people who didn't act like he did, who didn't leave the IS in a ship there. One of them was a man named Stan Weir. I don't know if that name means anything to you. Stan was a longshoreman in California for much of his life. I was a model for those of us who industrialized in the 70s. He became the model for Harvey Swales' book, Standing Fast, which was an example of somebody from that generation of the 40s who stayed a militant and fought despite the difficulties of being militant in the 50s. During the height of the Cold War. Another person that was a veteran of the old Chaparral group who didn't move right was Herman Benson, who formed the Association of Union Democracy, which offered legal support to insurgents and labor movement. I mean, these, to my mind, were heroes. They stayed in the IS. Herman was a friend of the IS. Stan Weir stayed in the IS. They didn't give up on party building. At the same time, they didn't fetishize it. And in many ways, they were heroes in a way that I think Draper never was. I don't want to get into a fight with should Draper have done this as opposed to done that. It's a given. But the piece that we're discussing in itself, I think, is terribly short-sighted. I also agree with much of the other speakers. We're in a situation in which the economy that was able to buttress reformism in the trade union movement is gone. Whether it's Trump or Bernie Sanders, there is not going to be the ability to win the kind of concessions from the ruling class that were done in the past, or even class compromises. That period is over. What is possible is another question, and you're as capable of responding to this as I am, possibly even more so. That's all I've got to say. All right, thank you. That's all I've got to say.
Yes, just taking off of this. Well, first of all, I think that I don't know. I'm not a Draper scholar, so I don't know if he thought the answers to the present lay in the past, and in the study of Marxism. But I would still urge the study of Marxism because it is a rich vein of revolutionary experience, and by going back to original sources, as I have over the years, you find out that many of the versions of this history that you learned in various organizations you've been and that are current in the world are not completely true. You find in them ideas that you never knew existed, and many of which can be applicable. I don't think you have to throw out the revolutionary past in order to deal with the present. I think it's still very valid. It's not going to repeat itself, but it is valid. On what Michael is it?
Right.
Michael said, I think that's the dilemma that we face. We are being drawn into a reformist enthusiasm that has no future due to the objective conditions as far as I can see. That is, of resurrecting the New Deal. But the enthusiasm is nevertheless there. I don't think it's possible because the crisis of capitalism is not that profound yet. The ruling classes are very self-satisfied, they're very arrogant, and very unwilling to make concessions. So the question is, what happened when the reformist hopes raised by this new wave are disappointed, which they are sure to be. And we've seen examples like this, for instance, in Greece, where they elected a party with an electoral strategy that failed, and the enthusiasm, the wave of enthusiasm that greeted Syriza and the popular support has faded very quickly, and it turned into disillusion. And so the question is, we may see something very similar to that when Sanders fails to get the nomination, as I think he will.
Right.
Sanders or Warren, and those folks are dashed, that people feel demoralized as a result. So the question is, is to point out, without dismissing the movement that is arisen now, to point out in a very friendly way the limitations of this perspective. And the question that it presents, we have a society that is largely deindustrialized, so that the old strategy of going into the unions, of implanting yourself in factories and so forth and so on, doesn't have the objective basis that it had in the 50s and 60s. So the question is, how do you mobilize people outside of elections? What is the ground game of the left under today's circumstances?
Absolutely.
Spencer, if you'd like to respond.
Yes. I wanted to pick up on some of the things that the other panel said. One thing that I think is right, and just to flesh it out a bit further, in what Michael pointed out, is that for Draper, the working class in its own institutions, the trade unions, the labor movement, had to be the basis of any political project. So he focused strongly, for instance, on Marx's activity in collaboration with the English trade unionists in the First International. Meanwhile, this is his model, because the question of party didn't even have to be raised there, exactly, because the English trade unionists were tailing the liberals, and the question of when that break would come, and certainly as a result of Marxist political activity, was very open-ended or simply unclear in the 1860s and early 70s. The issue of the conservatism of trade unionism, of the counter-revolutionary, or at least, if you will, Bonapartist tendencies emerging from within socialist politics, and specifically emerging from trade union leaders, as was most dramatically exemplified by the German Revolution, is a question that Draper seeks to avoid almost entirely. He talks about Marx, he talks about Lenin. And when he talks about Lenin, he likes to talk about the limit of what is to be done. He likes to talk about the orthodox, if you will, Kautskyan Lenin. The question of the operation of imperialism and its effects within socialist politics, it's the generation of, if you will, petty bourgeois tendencies within socialist politics, the result of the labor lieutenants of capital leading socialist politics and definitively influencing socialist politics. These are questions that Draper is chary of, really to the point of it being a kind of trauma. And the trauma is rooted in the fact of the IS tendencies, identification of Stalinism as anti-democratic. And so he wants to see workers' democracy as, in a sense, the bedrock of Marxism. And Marx's own and Marxism's critique of democracy, that in a fundamental sense, democracy generates petty bourgeois politics and seduces elements of the working class to it, is something that that Draper really, you almost get a sense that Draper thinks that workers' politics carried through to the end would result in the emergence of a labor party that would have a majority that could simply be elected into the institute of the dictatorship of the proletariat. His sort of Stalinophobia, I think, drives him to that. I guess the challenge that I want to put to the other two panelists is the issue of what really could have been done in the 1970s. I'm unwilling to say that the objective conditions of the 1970s rendered, in a sense, politics moot. I think if socialist politics depends upon material deprivation, we could be waiting a very long time for socialism. This period of neoliberalism has, after all, been a massive engine of wealth creation, lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in China, in India, and in Africa. The famines that you saw on television when I was a child, and certainly I know that you would have been familiar with in the middle of the 20th century, these are really confined to wartime conditions in Africa today. And I don't think that there's any problem in capitalism producing material wealth. It's a question of unfreedom. It's a question of the lack of capacity to participate in society. It's massive unemployment, etc. It's social disintegration that's the issue. So I guess I would press on that. And I don't have an opinion. I'm not taking Draper's side versus anybody's side in the 1970s. But I don't think that the question of objective conditions really gets at the heart of the crisis that was faced with the collapse of the new left after 1968. I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to open up to questions. And so first, I have a question, and then you'll be next. but we'll take one at a time.
I wanted to take up on Spencer's comment about checkpoint conditions. So behind Draper in this whole political conversation seems to lie also the question of the earlier 20th century and Stalinism and Trotsky's opposition to Stalinism. So the question is, like, if all of these projects of microstates are meaningless because of objective conditions, then the question is, was Trotsky's whole project from particularly 33 on, or maybe earlier with the left opposition, with the Fourth International and so forth, was that also essentially the creation of an international microstate? In other words, were there objective conditions in which that might have made sense, or was that already a delusion? And another is a comment that says, I've been thinking a lot about the history of turn of the century, 1890s, up to world, to the 20s, Russia-Soviet Union. So there's several things about the Bolshevik Revolution that are actually unusual and perhaps unique in terms of the history of. So you have the Leninist part, and you have not only the Leninists, because it's not just the Bolsheviks, it's particularly Lenin. Right? The Bolsheviks on their own without Lenin's leadership probably would not have taken power, almost certainly not. But you also have the phenomenon of Soviets, right? Which is not standard in governments that came to power. So in Cuba and China, in Eastern Europe, etc., you didn't have Soviets that the party could interact with. And the other point, which always seems to be alighted, is that if you look at the period of Soviet power, you have like the ease of the Bolsheviks taking power in 1917 and the triumphal march of Soviet power up to, say, the middle of 1918. But what enabled them to keep power was a brutal civil war. So the whole experience of Bolshevism is really that narrative of 1917, but the reality is actually based to a large extent on a military struggle. But the actual reality of the Soviet Union emerged not from the Bolshevik Party or the Soviets, but the ability to maintain power militarily. That's it. Comments, particularly on the first part, which is the question.
Want me to?
Okay. Yeah, let's do one. Yeah. We have plenty of time, and there's not a lot of people in the room, so let's do one at a time.
Okay. And let's do Trotsky's approach. And in the Fourth International, people talk in Trotsky's sense about rebuilding the Fourth International. But I don't think it was ever really built in the first place. It was still born. Now, facing the conditions that Trotsky did in the 1930s, I don't know what else a revolutionary could have done, because capitalism was still in profound crisis. And Trotsky was of the opinion that this was the final crisis of capitalism. He was more entrenched in that opinion than he'd been in the 20s. The revolutionary tide went out in 1923, but there were subsequent revolutionary opportunities. The last big one, being Spain. So to try, as best he could, to overcome what he called the crisis of leadership and establish himself establish a small party to carry out the necessary tasks was all that he could have done. But ultimately, he was wrong. Capitalism was not on its last leg. It was not in its death agony, and it revived as a result of in the post-war period. In fact, it enjoyed its biggest period of expansion, and I don't think that expansion was an objective condition that made revolutionary politics very difficult. I don't think it is material deprivation alone. But I think you have to understand the experience of the generations which have known war and depression in the previous period, and now experience a continuum
incremental improvements in their lives. If people see such incremental improvements as a real prospect and think that it is going to continue, they are not going to be inclined to join revolutionary party. Revolution is a very hard thing. It makes very difficult demands of people. So I think that the gamble of the Russian Revolution was that is the belief that this was a, this was the final crisis of capitalism, capitalist productive forces had reached their outer limits, and that we either see proletarian revolution or a general decline of society. That was Trotsky's view. Turned out to be wrong. I mean, there's no way to put it.
I've always had mixed feelings about what was possible in that period. On one level, the transitional program suggested that the crisis of mankind is the crisis of leadership. That strikes me as ahistorical. You know, whatever was wrong with class relations in the 1930s, the absence of leadership wasn't an explanation. The absence of leadership was a problem that had to be explained and not a given. It strikes me in retrospect as a fool's project. But if you don't do that, what else do you do? I have no bloody idea.
Yeah, I feel the same.
I have no bloody idea. That's all I want to say.
Okay, then we'll go to the next. Do you want to respond?
Yeah. I think that I might describe Draper as a recovering set addict. I think it's because he's formed from his youth by the experience of Trotskyism. He really is a pure product of this. He was a member of the Socialist Party's youth group for a very short period of time before he was drawn over to Trotsky.
The French term.
Before the fifth. Yes, that's right. And so Draper was born in 14. He's formed by that experience. And what I'm trying to say about his position in 1971 to 1973 is, on the one hand, there is the experience in the 20th century of defeat. And that defeat is not merely the absence of revolution, but the presence of ongoing practices that block the way to revolution. And those include, but are not limited to, ideological practices. They also include organizational practices. And that I take it to be the substance of his critiques and heritage. That it's a roadblock, that it's not just it's not just a wrong idea, but it will block the way. What does he put in its place? He puts in its place, in effect, the idea that capitalism still exists. And because capitalism still exists, history can, will, must repeat itself. That the history of the 19th century will come back. That we can repeat the process of forming the labor movement, the development of socialism in the 19th century, and indeed the rediscovery of revolutionary ideas. Right? That's why I identified Draper with ideas drawn from the Frankfurt School about negative dialectics. That what he's saying is not just about the future of capitalism and the new forms of capitalism, but he's also attentive to the repetition, the regression, the eternal return of the same in capitalism. And that is the aspect that I find to be most interesting, regardless.
He just said, I'm going to write about the history of Marxism for the rest of my life. And I'm not going to be subject to any discipline on that matter. You asked about, so he's reflecting on the life of Trotsky. And I don't know that he has any better of an idea than Michael or Jim, or certainly I had, about what should have been done in the 1930s. But he does know that it's spent.
He does know
it's spent. It's spent, and whatever could, and very little came out of the new left. And that's the real point that he's making, is that there's nothing to build upon in the 1970s. There's only the question of, in a sense, capitalism's own generation of discontent and the necessary return of the question of socialism. And I think that's the hardest pill for the older interpreters of Hal Draper, the new left generation themselves, to come to terms with, is that he's really saying this was largely middle class discontent. And that's, I think, the interest of what he's, of the analysis of the struggle groups, right, in that 6 month period that you talked about, where he's really saying, look, these new left cadre that we've recruited, they are averse to socialism. They don't think the working class can do it. That brings us back to Jim's question, which is, what about when there is no labor movement anymore? And that's what I find to be so strange about the young people's fascination with this document. Because it really presupposes 30% unionization in the United States. It really is about a rank and file strategy, whether there's a party or just a Marxist center. And obviously that strategy has no, as you put it, objective basis.
So David's next question, and then Victor will be after that. And we still have 30 minutes, so you'll definitely both get in your questions.
I'm getting all the answers.
My name is David Kyle, and I'm with the organizing committee for the...
Could you speak up, please?
Okay, David Kyle. I'm with the Organizing Committee for a Democratic Revolutionary Left, which I'll get to, but I'm interested also in who else is here. That's probably why I'm identifying myself. And I appreciate the looking back at the work of Hal Draper, and I haven't read that, but the use of the word microsect in the title seems almost prophetic. 2 years ago, who would have called ISL a microsect? It was a big operation. Now, it's not even a microsect, it's dust. And the question is, what will be the next dust? What will be the next group that turns to dust? I want to appreciate also the work of the Platypus Affiliated Society. And I'm curious, on the issue of political centers, it's been suggested the SA is the political center, and I hope we could agree on that. And I look to Platypus to some degree as a political center. It's been around since 2007, and I'm reading here the Marxist left appears as a historical ruin. This is 2007. All the more true now, a vanquished tradition. And I'm reading also that, according to Platypus, what has the left been and what can it become? Platypus exists because the answer to such a question has long ceased to be self-evident, which I think is a warranted modesty that we can have about our ability to know just what needs to be done. It's really a question. How Platypus, I get it, is raising the question of what is to be done, what should we be doing. And so I look to Platypus as one political center with a certain focus, Marxism, and DSA is in a different way. And maybe what we have are multiple political centers, and maybe we should embrace that, because thinking in terms of one center has not worked. And so I would suggest that one other possible center is this organizing committee, which has a program. It's a different approach from Platypus, but at the same time, when I look at Platypus, I can think of myself as a sympathizer, a supporter, or a member, and I would hope we would be able to have overlapping memberships in different projects, including DSA.
Do you have a question, or is that it? If I take your
I'd ask for any comments on those ideas and on the notion of a political center.
Do you want to respond, or should we take the next question as well? Yeah, if you could.
The topic was, what is a political center? And I really don't care about Hans Draper. That's not what I came here for. My name is Victor Madison. I led three panels on Thomas Paine. And then there was a panel that just blew me out of the water. It was Cornel West, Chris Hedges, and Richard Wolff. And it's on C-SPAN 2, so you can watch it. Big auditorium. He's our premier revolutionary. Why would you want to go puddling around in Russia when you have proof of a successful revolution right here? We've got a few $2 bills, which I'll sell you for two $1 bills. And on the back, and this is Ralph Nader's favorite currency, I carry it because I'm the National Lodge president of Thomas Paine Friends. And I use it as a conversation piece about what Thomas Paine did. And I've got a whole page about him if you care. But why reinvent the wheel? I mean, if you read his philosophy and counterpoise it like Hamilton's philosophy, then he went to France and helped write their constitution. The counterpoint to a fascist system is a system based on a constitution. Fascism is the Führer Prinzip, the aristocracy rules. The counterpoint is rule of law. In terms of a solution, I would point you to the Romero Institute, headed by Danny Sheehan. He has whole college courses on this. He just finished one. I'm talking syllabus, 10 weeks, two classes a week. If any of you don't know who Romero was, he was the bishop who was killed in Salvador. He was recently canonized by the Catholic Church. And I would point you to him because he has a whole layout, a whole structure of explaining the current problem. But the center, I mean, what do you have a problem with what we fought World War II about? You know, freedom of fear, freedom of want? You know, that was a medal. This is the most popular medal given by the United States. And it commemorated the victory in World War II. The Four Freedoms. You have a problem with the Four Freedoms? I mean, there's the political center for you. Why reinvent the wheel?
I'm at a loss, but I would take one of your $2 bills. Are you giving those up?
Yes, for $2.
Maybe.
You can get 100 of these at some banks.
I didn't get your name.
David.
Just in response to David, I'm not sure that Platypus is a political center. I certainly agree that people can belong to many different organizations. And there's no reason why they shouldn't. I mean, the reason why the wheel was reinvented a long time ago, right? The politics of Thomas Paine, revered as they are in the radical left, came up against their own limitations. And I invite you to read the history of the 19th century. Right? This was the politics of the radical left in Great Britain. That gave rise to Chartism, that gave rise to the first mass movement of the working class, a politics that would not have made sense to Thomas Paine. And Thomas Paine would have no answer, and really would probably be driven to suicide by looking at the morbid symptoms of capitalism, a concept that's foreign to him. He doesn't experience capitalism. He lives in bourgeois society. He has no idea of mass unemployment. He has no idea hundreds of millions, even billions of people who are under underemployed.
He has, these are not problems that even the Jacobin tradition, which in some ways I would counterpose to the legacy of Thomas Paine, as valuable as those legacies are, there's no real reason to refight the struggles of the Girondins and the Jacobins, but there were differences at the time. But that entire French Revolutionary tradition is the inheritance of socialism, and it proves inadequate. And those are the lessons of Marx. That's what the Revolution of 1848 really is telling Marx. We can't just refight the French Revolution and draw out the conflict between the sans-culottes and the property owners, the conflict within the Third Estate. Right? Rather, that conflict will resolve itself in the Bonapartist state, in a post-class form of state that is undergirded by mass democracy. This is the question of Marxism. And this is, so the wheel was reinvented a long time ago for very good reasons, because there was the emergence of socialism. It doesn't mean that there's any contempt or dismissal of the legacy of liberalism. It's simply, what I guess I would take to be...
And the emergence of socialism is a response to the emergence of capitalism, industrial capitalism.
Exactly. That's another way of putting it, is that Thomas Paine has no real concept of the Industrial Revolution. And of the problem that it creates.
But he does about removing the fascists, removing the aristocracy. And before you get to socialism, you got to remove the obstacle.
It's an inadequate understanding. It's an inadequate understanding of fascism to analogize it to the struggle against the Ancien Régime.
Yeah. Okay. If I could just say a couple of things. First of all, I don't know. I'm responding to you, and I don't know what you mean by this kind of return of the same. In other words, it seems to me that class struggle arises and has different forms, but the one thing that we can be sure of is that the class struggle, although it may have been placed on hold, or may not have been central to politics for a long time, is bound to resurface. And that the two main class actors of capitalist society, the working class and the capitalist class, are still bound to be the main contenders, although the composition of the working class has changed dramatically. So I don't know if you reject that version of the return of the conditions of Marxism, the conditions in which Marxism. Yeah, but I think it is perfectly valid to expect that at some point capitalism still goes into crisis. The working class is still pushed down from time to time, and these things reemerge. So the class struggle doesn't go away. I would say about reformism. The reformism that you see, we have in this new socialist manifesto out by Bascom, Sankara, we have Jacobin. And what they are reformists, but with this difference. That unlike the reformists of the previous period, 60s and 70s, that simply dismissed revolutionaries as wholly unrealistic, the people around Jacobin are very conscious of revolutionary arguments and the validity of some of them, like that if reforms go too far, capitalists begin moving capital out of the country, go on a capitalist strike, or that even if reforms are successful, the capitalist class is always there trying to take them back. They understand that. And therefore the reform has certain limits. What they have settled on is what I call the Kautsky synthesis. That is the synthesis of Karl Kautsky and his Road to Power in 1909, in which he basically says that the working class is making a steady advance on the legislative and the trade union fronts, and that if this advance continued, then the bourgeoisie may panic and attack democracy and so forth and so on, and then the working class will have to respond by revolutionary means. What that amounted to is basically reform now, and revolution maybe tomorrow. What the DSA, as represented by Jacobin, are saying is that for now we can continue to work within the Democratic Party and canvas for left democratic politicians, but that at some future point, this may call forth a crisis in which reformist methods, these incremental methods, don't work. I think the main worry I have is that the way capitalism is constituted today, those periods of incremental advance are very short-lived, if they are possible at all. So that the capitalist class, the globalized capitalist class, is so well armed against these things that when they begin to raise their heads, the response is swift and often annihilated. We've seen that in the case of Mitterrand in France, of Syriza in Greece. So that incrementalism with revolution, revolutionary conflict put off into the future might not work.
Let me shift the discussion slightly. It's absolutely right that the left forum ought to be discussing what the left to do. But we don't operate in isolation as though if wishes were horses, fools would ride. There's also an organized right wing in this country that is using racism very effectively. Rush Limbaugh is a genius at this. Rush Limbaugh was able to take criticisms of our last president and argue rather effectively that this was not merely a centrist who was trying to operate, how would I describe how he operated? Badly. But if we were to describe Obama, we would say basically he was a centrist. He made comforting noises, but basically was a safe person to administer capitalism in a certain period, and that he did very little for working people on the one hand, while doing real harm internationally. Still in all, he was an exemplar compared to the present Bonaparte administration. What Limbaugh and the far right was able to do was to suggest that he was representative of insurgent people of color who were going to take away the culture and the rights of white people, and did that very, very effectively, scared the shit out of people who we were never able to reassure. In part because we were not there, in part because we were no longer working in the mills, in part because we never had the political, the propaganda machine to reach people in that way. And our press was small. Even the Nation magazine, does it even have 100,000 circulation? All the left-wing publications are de minimis compared to what they were even 15, 20 years ago. The right wing is not in control of politics yet, but it's poised to do so. We have to take that very seriously. We cannot simply say we want to have a revolutionary party that's going to be X, Y, and Z. We have to have one that is prepared to fight and prepared to recognize who the enemies are. Now, the Communist Party traditionally has always seen the far right as the only enemy and has tried to do a center-left coalition. I'm not going to argue that that is wrong or that is right. It depends upon the context, depends upon the array of forces. But I do think that any discussion that we have in terms of what is possible for the left has to take as a starting point, who is the opposition? And the opposition isn't just the quote-unquote ruling class. I was stunned that the New York Times endorsed the insurgent candidate for DA in Queens. That's something I could have possibly predicted. That says something about their concerns. That says something about who they want to see, who they want to play up to, and who they're generally concerned about, and who they want to have control of. I think it's something that will only be on the table, and we shouldn't leave that to simply the Communist Party to raise the flag for a popular unity movement. That's all.
Can we agree on the cover of this book, Fascist, You're Next, as a unifying idea? Goes back to World War II. Fascist,
no, because it implies that nationalism implies fascism.
Well, no, it doesn't. The
ruling class doesn't need the fascists right now, but it could in the future. And the fact is that it's doing nothing to tamp them down.
If I may respond to something that Jim said, the repetitious character of capitalism is really about the Marxist understanding of the dialectic of capital. In the very formula MCM prime, it's an eternal repetitious cycle that, of course, is disintegrative because every time it repeats, it's generating employment. Right? Even as it's generating employment, even the very purchase of labor depends upon the elimination of the necessity for labor. Right? And that's foreign to the notion of bourgeois society as exemplified by someone like Adam Smith or Thomas Paine, for whom the notion of unemployment is literally inconceivable as a fundamental feature of society. Politically, it's that when the discontent of society recreates revolutionary situations, the ghosts of the past return. This is why Marx is loves to talk about ghosts and vampires, right? Marx loves to talk about the undead, because for Marx, and this is why he can talk about the great living heart of the proletariat, right? that the defeats contribute and point towards the proletarian revolution. In the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, the image is the myth of Antaeus, where Hercules' labor is to defeat the son of the earth, the demon Antaeus, who every time he throws him to the ground, his mother regenerates his body. As he throws him to the earth recreates him in strength, and so he gets more and more formidable until the circumstances themselves cry out, hic robus, hic salter, right? That passage is one of repetition. Right. It's not one of progress, it's not one of the dynamism of capital, which of course Marx is also very aware of. And so it's the static within the static character of capital within its dynamism that I would argue is at the heart of Marxism. Why, for Lenin, Rosenberg, and Trotsky, what's happening in 1905 and in 1917 is the return of 1848. Rosa Luxemburg says in 1918, the Communist Manifesto is our program. We stand with Marx and Engels on the eve of 1948. Right? It's that question. That's what's lost. That's what was lost in the 20th century. It was any historical consciousness that connected the present to the revolutionary past. And that's because of the disorganization of parties, of organizations that could have carried that historical consciousness. Right? It's that dissolution of historical consciousness that transforms conditions from ones of mere capitalism or mere ripeness for revolution to what Trotsky calls overripeness. Right? To the question of capitalism, in a sense, without its own fundamental
socialism is almost incomprehensible. It's socialism that makes capitalism comprehensible. Right? It's what makes it itself, actually. It's the trade union struggle, the political struggle to limit the working day that creates the category of relative surplus value that, in a sense, allows capital itself to be realized as a comprehensible option. Right? So it's that disintegration that we face. That's why I describe the 20th century as one of, it's in a sense worse than counter-revolution. Because counter-revolution was met by the Marxist tradition in 1851. It was met in 1871 without a liquidation of the project of socialism. Right? Draper's facing that, I think semi-subconsciously, in 1973.
You think that the project of socialism was liquidated completely in 1973?
I think it was, in a sense, liquidated in 1923. Certainly at some point for Draper, he's saying this old strategy of assuming that in a sense, ringing the changes of the Trotskyist changes of injuryism and splitting and so forth, this is not going to work. And he doesn't know what's going to work, I think. But this is what's best about it is a confession of agnosticism.
The thing that's kind of striking about the present is that the Soviet Union survived to it. Soviet power survived two massive counter-revolutionary attacks during the Civil War, and then an even bigger one during the Second World War, and then it collapsed out of its internal disintegration quite peacefully. Right.
With some pressure from the West.
But the pressure was nothing compared to what it had previously endured. So really, the internal decay was what did it in. And then the other question I had is, like, people thought that a microsect, but isn't there the possibility for a macrosect? Like what point does a microsect like just be, you could be a fairly big microsect, and still
if we had to isolate one thing that left has to do, and there are many things the left has to do, but the one thing it has to do, and its mission, is a class unity. There's everything in capitalism that suggests divisions. The function of the left is to foster a sense of moving a class in itself to a class for itself. Some people say that's voluntarism, but that's also politics. And if we're not doing that, we don't have a sense of how to do that. We have some inkling of to what way we can contribute to that. We're just spinning our wheels. I think of that a lot because much of my life has been spent in journalism and seeing the absolute shit that gets sent in the mass media. From MSNBC further right, there's a notion that we don't have classes so much as we have individual citizens, and the citizens are represented in Congress. And it's a representative government. And your interests are individual and only episodically collective. We believe that our interests are fundamentally collective, but that point has to be underscored again and again and again. It's what we tried to do when we were in the industry. The fact that there is a small number of industrial workers working in plants in one place where they can talk together and begin to have a common identity, and that has been frayed, just means that our work is that much more difficult and that much more problematic. But the notion of class unity is not going to be central. We're not talking about that. I don't know what we're talking about.
We have about 5 more minutes, so the panelists want to wrap up.
Yeah, I would say just to, in a sense, that picking up on what Michael was saying, that's in a sense the, I think the one way you put it, that is the political testament of Hal Draper. The political testament of Hal Draper is, if Marxism is not about class independence,
is not about anything. That's the one thing he's certain of, and that's what, in a sense, that's what's motivating his sort of rank and file orientation, even though he himself doesn't carry that through. The IS does, or the generation of the new left does, and he abstains, perhaps even from creating a Marxist center, perhaps his publications were in no sense contributing to that cause. I think when the struggle to overcome the crisis of socialism fails, it leaves us with not only no answer to the question of what ought to have been done, if something wasn't done and didn't succeed, there's simply nothing to analyze. And so the question
is, why it didn't succeed?
Right. I mean, how will we ever say, what were the 1960s and 70s a time in which socialism was possible or not? Or the constitution of the political parties that could lead to socialism or other preconditions for socialism could have been constituted yet weren't? How can we say what your generation face? I don't have
the answers.
I think we can say
two things.
Yes.
And I think we can say that the difference between the 30s and the 40s and the 60s is, and my father was an undergraduate of Haiti. My father was an organizer, union organizer for the Communist Party. His experience of socialism was a proletarian experience. I was on the cutting edge of the 60s, born in 1947. A participant in SDS, in the student rebellion, my experience was not a proletarian experience. And I don't think the rise of the new left in the 1960s essentially was. I think it was a middle class phenomenon which may explain. I think that Draper was active in the free speech movement in Berlin, but there was a basic discomfort with the new left based on his proletarian socialism. What arose in the 1960s had some spillover to the working class, but it's not a working class movement.
Right, but the generation of the new left turned towards the new communist movement and the industrialization, their self-industrialization in the 1970s, as however they would put it, they became ideologically serious after 1968, after the rediscovery of Marxism under various pressures. In 1967, 68, 69. The question is, was that doomed to failure? I don't know. What I'm suggesting is that the task, that the present is haunted, indeed shaped by tasks unfulfilled, and that remains the task of the revolution of 1848. That the task of Marx haunts even the DSA. Why do they need to publish articles about Marx and Lenin if all they want to do is simply to be reformist liberals? Why do they need to, in a sense, jack themselves up on Marxism in order to conduct the contradiction?
Because they also want to be Marxists, in some sense.
That makes it much more. That's what he's asking.
Well, okay, thank you everyone. It is noon, as Jim taught me, not 12
p.m. Coming with paper next time.
So in 30 minutes, we will be hosting another panel in this room called the New Zealand